I'm thankful we at least have today before the holiday shopping mania starts. Just kidding. It's already well underway. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's November the 22nd. Thanks for tuning in this Thanksgiving, a.k.a. pre-Black Friday for the more commercially minded among us. For the first time this year, retail sales are expected to pass $1 trillion for the Christmas holiday season, according to research firm eMarketer. More than $100 billion of that will be sales through e-commerce. In addition to your hard-earned cash, those retailers are after something else, something that's perhaps just as valuable. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
At the holidays, we buy things we don't typically buy because we're shopping for others. But retailers are still collecting data off those one-time purchases.
The genius is knowing what to do with it.
That's Susie Ross, a retail advisor at Accenture. She says customers can face the usual onslaught in their inboxes.
Bombarding them with an email, with a discount or a promotion.
Zolt Katana, business professor at UC Berkeley, says that can be effective, but
only if the person, if the shopper is interested. And that usually is not the case for one-time shoppers.
The trick, says Jeffrey Gallick, marketing professor at Carnegie Mellon University, is for retailers to figure out what we buy for ourselves and what we buy for other people.
How does Amazon know if that is a gift that's going to someone else and shouldn't be integrated into the recommendation system that they use for me? Or is it actually a product that I'm buying for myself and they should kind of update their algorithms?
But even if we're one-time customers, retailers can still make money off of us, Gallick says. They can sell our data to aggregators and other retailers who combine it with existing data on us.
And this just adds to that pool of information that they have, making it even richer.
They can then go on to resell it to somebody else. And that data can find its way back to us via promotions. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Even if it feels like Black Friday, it is still technically Thanksgiving, so let's talk about food for a bit. We'll get to the turkey in a moment, but I'll start with a side dish. North Carolina is the largest producer of sweet potatoes in the country. Almost three-quarters of the nation's fresh sweet potatoes are grown there, the ones you might use in dishes like my grandma's pie or my cousin Laura's casserole. But Hurricane Florence did a number on this year's crop, and the farmers who produced it. Marketplace's Andy Euler traveled to Fazin, North Carolina, and has this report.
Birch Farms is one of the largest vegetable growers in North Carolina. It covers about 8,000 acres in the southeastern part of the state. The farm's patriarch, Jimmy Birch, is busy rattling off what they grow here.
Collards, kale, cabbage, turnips, rutabagas, beets, and then we do a lot of sweet potatoes. That's our business.
When Hurricane Florence came through in September, Birch says his farm got 26 inches of rain in 4 days.
Yeah, it was over $1 million. Washed down to the Atlantic Ocean. It took me 4 or 5 years to make it back.
Birch didn't know the full extent of his loss until he began digging his sweet potatoes out of the ground a couple of weeks ago. He ended up losing a third of his crop. He said it kicked his...
That's what happened. It was bad, very bad.
About 95% of the sweet potatoes in North Carolina were in the ground when Hurricane Florence hit, according to Larry Wooten. He's president of the North Carolina Farm Bureau. He says the sweet potato crop took a 20 to 40% loss because of Florence. And while there should be enough for the holidays, supply may be a bit sparse next year.
Many people say that, well, farmers have crop insurance on these crops. You do on some of these major commodities like corn, soybeans, cotton, but you don't have it on sweet potatoes.
Jimmy Birch says even before the storm, things weren't looking good for farmers like him. Escalating labor costs and competition from overseas have squeezed margins for years.
Farmers are really great people overall, but we're a dying breed, and there's nobody coming along to take our place. And I don't know who in the hell is going to feed this world after a while.
In order to keep up with population growth, the United Nations estimates that worldwide food production will need to double by 2050. In Fazin, North Carolina, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
And with many people off for the holiday, it's a good day if you're a company with bad news. Today, Tesla announced it was cutting the price of a couple of its models in China, effectively eating some of the tariffs China imposed in the ongoing trade war with the U.S. And the Wall Street Journal reported that Apple plans to discount its newest iPhone in Japan, reacting to a tepid response from consumers. Luckily for both companies, U.S. markets are closed today. But we'll have numbers for you anyway. All this week, we've been hearing from people about their cool jobs, how to get the job, and what it's like to do it. For the latest in our series, How to Be a Blank, we spoke to Shannon O'Connor. She's done animation for The Simpsons, Futurama, and lots of other projects. But she got her start when an animator discovered her doing airbrush art at a theme park. And she turned his letter of recommendation into a job as a production assistant for the movie Space Jam. I'll let her tell the rest of the story.
I met a bunch of people there, and they helped me learn how to do what they call character in-betweens, which is all the drawings that go in between. And you're like, whoa, who does that? And there's a person who does that. I just went home every single night, and I practiced after my PA job, and I showed it to my boss, and I just kind of talked my way into a job as an artist by the end of the movie. I got to draw the Looney Tunes, and mostly I just sat at a desk and thought it was the coolest thing ever that I was getting paid to do something like that, and I didn't go to art school or anything. Eventually, I got hired on The Simpsons. I did character layout on The Simpsons. You kind of have to put the characters in their environment, make sure they are in the space correctly, and then do the key poses of the animation. I think it's important to know how to draw. I didn't go to art school, so I guess it's proven that you don't have to go to art school. But if you don't go to art school, you have to want to do this because you're going to have to work really hard and draw every day. Get an Instagram account, post your art, get to know other artists. I feel like so much of what happens is who you know or just somebody else knowing that you're capable of doing something and wanting to give you the opportunity to do it. There's so many more opportunities now for people with their own individual style. I don't feel like that was as big of a thing back when I started, but now developing your own style, I think, is important because it kind of sets you apart from everybody else. Right now, I'm a story artist, so I'm thinking differently now than I was thinking when I was a character designer. Now I'm thinking cinematic, I'm thinking storytelling, and I'm thinking about the shots or the acting, the important main acting of the characters. So where's this character going to be? What's going to best sell this moment? I can look at entire sections of certain shows that I've worked on, and I'm like, oh, I was there. I was there late that night. I came up with that. I drew that animation, that acting came from my point of view or something. Or when you see a character that you've designed and you see it actually walking and talking, it's pretty cool because somebody else brought it to life. You just came up with a design and now there it is, walking around.
Shannon O'Connor works in animation in Los Angeles, California. You can see some of her work and tell us about some dream jobs that pique your curiosity at marketplace.org. Thank you. There's been a big push to make corporate America more inclusive lately. From tech to media, many companies are trying to build workplace cultures that are more welcoming for women, for people of color, and for people with disabilities. Kat Holmes led inclusive design initiatives at Microsoft. Now she does the same for Google. And she has a new book out called Mismatch: How Inclusion Shapes Design. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Kimberly. Thanks for having me.
You talk in your book about inclusivity and exclusion from your own personal experience. How does your personal experience shape how you think of inclusive design?
One thing that I recognized when I was writing this book is that there is a deeper personal connection. And it really came down to exclusion. When I was in high school, you know, moved out to a community where I was suddenly one of five non-Caucasian students. And the experiences that ensued strongly shaped my experience as a high schooler. And the thing that's evolved over my career, my education, is that translated into how we make things in the world. You know, how many different ways do people experience those same kind of moments of being told that they don't belong? Not just to the words we say to each other and not just to the way we treat each other, but the way that we design with and for one another.
So let's give a real specific example of something that represents inclusive design.
My favorite example is keyboards. The very first keyboard was invented by Pellegrino Turi and the Countess Carolina de Fivizzano. And the Countess was blind. And this was in the mid-1800s. And at that time, in order to write letters, if you were blind, you had to speak your note to somebody who would write it down for you. And out of necessity of communication and keeping their communications private, together they invented the first prototype of what we now know as a typewriter. And this made it possible for the Countess to author her own letters. But that design, that solution, has gone on to benefit many, many more people, as we know now, as a primary way of interacting with computing interfaces.
So then what is the business case for inclusive design? Why should this be something that companies like Microsoft or Google or eBay or whatever, why is this something they should be thinking about?
There are many ways to think about the business case for inclusive design. One of them would be growing market share. You know, when we design a solution that works well across different demographics, different life stages, abilities, it starts to stretch how we think about who can benefit from our solutions. But I think underneath all of these kinds of business benefits, the real heart of it is that inclusive design is about interrupting habits and taking a moment to learn how to recognize exclusion. You think of like a video game controller. If you're playing a game, you're probably holding a device in your hands that requires two hands. That game controller, in a way, says to people, gaming is for you or it's not for you.
Are there times, though, when inclusive design just doesn't make sense? For example, when it makes a product more expensive to produce for everyone, but it only helps a few more people?
I am a pretty firm believer that inclusive design is always going to make sense. I've worked with a really wide range of companies across a broad set of industries, from tech to, you know, children's educational materials or playground and recreational design. And I've seen again and again that it helps teams reframe the problem they think they're solving. More often than not, I've seen teams end up on the other end of the process with a solution that maybe cost less than they had initially expected. And so the idea of willingness becomes less about should and shouldn't we, and more about which path do we want to take towards the more inclusive outcomes that we're committed to.
Kat Holmes, her book is called Mismatch. Thanks a lot, Kat.
Thanks so much, Kimberly.
Coming up,
a legal case is going to have its own unique outcome.
For investors, how the courtroom became a commodity. But first, let's do the numbers. As I mentioned before, the markets are closed today for the holiday, which leaves us to discuss what everyone really cares about, the food. According to the National Turkey Federation, we gobbled up 5.3 billion pounds of turkey last year. Farmers raised 242 million birds, an industry valued at nearly $5 billion, according to the government's 2017 numbers. That was actually a decline from 2016, when turkey production clocked in at more than $6 billion. The Turkey Federation estimates that production and processing in the U.S. employs about 374,600 people. But whatever graces your Thanksgiving table today, those of us at Marketplace wish you a delicious holiday.
Hi, I'm Zach, and I listen to Marketplace in Arlington, Virginia. I think what I appreciate the most about Marketplace is their ability to take the economic news of the day, issues such as tariffs, rate hikes, and tax reform, cut through the political noise, and clearly and concisely explain not only how these issues affect our country and the rest of the world, but how they impact people like me. I hope you'll consider joining me as a Marketplace investor and donate today at marketplace.org to help make their work possible.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Like Erica mentioned earlier, we haven't even made it through Thanksgiving, and some retailers have already started their Black Friday sales. The toy industry has had a mixed year, to say the least. Toys R Us is no more, and the big toy manufacturers are under pressure. With billions of dollars at stake, accurately guessing what children will want for the holidays is crucial for the industry. The Toy Retailers Association unveiled its guesses at the Dream Toys event in London recently. The BBC's Elizabeth Hodson went to check it out.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
It's mid-November, which is crunch time for the toy industry. Christmas sales in the UK alone are predicted to be around $1.5 billion this year, so it's vital for toy companies to get their products to the top of Christmas lists. Two of this year's big trends are unicorns and slime, and MGA Entertainment has created a toy which combines both. Abby Mattingly is from the company's PR team.
This is the Poopsie Surprise Unicorn. So it is a unicorn that poos glitter slime, which is crazy, but the kids absolutely love it.
If I wanted to make my own glitter slime poo, how would I go about it?
If you feed it some of the Poopsie food and the glitter, and then you give it some water, give it a good squeeze.
I'm pressing the button, and yes, as if by magic, a bright splodge of unicorn poo has glitter poo has appeared in the potty.
Yes, it has, and ta-ra, there you go, that's the Poopsie Unicorn Surprise.
Unicorn poo is a shiny new twist on slime, which as a toy goes back to the 1970s, and combining the trendy and traditional has been a speciality of Lego for decades. But recently, the Danish company's been struggling. Earlier this year, it revealed that sales in 2017 were 8% lower than the year before. That's the first drop in 13 years. This year, it's hoping that a prestigious film tie-in will inject some much-needed magic into the figures.
My name is Marius Lang. I'm the head of marketing for UK and Ireland for Lego.
One of the big films of this year is expected to be the prequel to Fantastic Beasts.
I'm scared, Professor Dumbledore.
Everyone is scared of something.
Ridiculous!
You see here the minifigure series that we have, which actually features four characters. There's even a little Niffler, and then we do have two other sets.
And another family favourite that's had a makeover is Monopoly. Its new version is a collaboration with the hugely popular video game Fortnite.
The world of Fortnite is filled with places to explore and loot to scavenge.
I'm Craig Wilkins, marketing director at Hasbro. As you go around the board, you're picking up different properties. You can build walls around that to protect yourself. But the storms come in, just like they do in the video game, and at that point, the world gets smaller. So it really plays into everything that kids are playing on Fortnite.
But popular toys don't come cheap. And Laura Seaton, who blogs as Tired Mummy of Two, has some tips to help Santa keep his costs down.
I start my Christmas shopping around September, keep an eye on when the sales are, the 3 for 2s, things like that. And I always know what's coming up and what the kids are interested in.
And is it better to get your toys really early or wait till the last minute?
There's certain products that only launch in October, so you've got to be careful of watching out for those. Things like slime, my daughter loves it. I know she's going to enjoy it, so I could grab that early and not worry about it. But if you're looking for the top toy, the one that they're really, really going to want, you're going to need to wait until around this time of year and look in the Black Friday sales for the best deal.
Well, it seems that when it comes to Christmas lists, it pays to be patient. In London, I'm the BBC's Elizabeth Hodson for Marketplace.
Justice in America is supposed to be available to all. In reality, the justice system can be expensive and inaccessible for many. But for investors, it can be lucrative. Some individuals and firms are bankrolling litigation, hoping they'll make back their investment and more from settlements and monetary damages. It's a little-known business that's largely unregulated. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Bradley George reports.
The CBS series The Good Fight has the courtroom confrontations and office politics you'd expect in a legal drama. But there's also a plot line about how lawsuits are funded. In this scene, a senior partner, played by Delroy Lindo, tries to convince a pair of financiers to invest in a class action case.
You finance 600 billable hours for an initial payment of $300,000. You share 40% of the award up to $8 million.
Law firms turn to litigation financing to help cover the costs of big, complex lawsuits. According to estimates, it's anywhere from a $5 to $10 billion industry in the United States. Chris Gillick is managing director at Colonnade Advisors, a Chicago investment bank that has tracked the rise of the industry. He wouldn't say if his firm is invested in litigation, but Gillick understands the appeal. People and companies are always going to sue each other.
That's the theory, certainly has played out so far in our history.
And that certainty is attractive to investors who can fund individual cases that promise a big return, like a class action or a product liability case. They can also buy equity in companies that do the financing. Gillick says investors can see returns as high as 20%. He says litigation finance is part of a growing nook of investment products that aren't tied to the ups and downs of the economy.
It doesn't track the equity markets. It doesn't track the debt markets. A legal case is going to have its own unique outcome.
There's another niche to this business that's getting attention from lawmakers in many states. It targets people who file personal injury lawsuits. Financing companies offer a kind of cash advance, an upfront chunk of an expected settlement. If the plaintiff wins, the company recoups the advance and takes part of the remaining settlement or damage award as a fee. The industry sees it as a service.
Our average funding for consumers is only about $2,000.
Eric Schuler is with the Alliance for Responsible Consumer Legal Funding, an industry trade group.
So this is something that can maybe help make a mortgage payment, a couple of car payments, keep some food on the table, make sure the utilities and the lights are on.
Schuler is quick to say the cash advances are not alone. That's because if plaintiffs lose their case, they owe nothing to the funding company. But Jenna Hashaway sees another reason for that distinction. She teaches law at Roger Williams University.
Once you call it a loan, it's subject to each state's usury statute, and most states have one. But by calling it something else, the industry manages to avoid regulation and sort of operate in the shadows.
And how much of a settlement or damage award companies keep depends on the state. In Tennessee, fees are capped at 15%. In Arkansas, it's 17%. But in most states, legal funders can charge whatever they want.
Often, when people take out these loans, their back's against the wall. If they've been injured in a car accident, they might not be working. So they're in this incredibly weak bargaining position, and they get taken advantage of by these lenders.
Schuler from the industry trade group says states shouldn't place limits on fees.
If we have a consumer that has a high risk type of a claim, the company should be available to cost projected appropriately.
New York Republican State Senator Robert Ort disagrees. Litigation financing is coming under increasing scrutiny in states, and Ort is working to pass a bill that would cap fees.
I have said from the beginning I don't want to destroy the industry, per se, because I realize there may be a spot for this kind of practice. But the idea that for some reason they should be ungoverned or exist on some different plateau from other loans or other kind of products of a similar nature, I just think doesn't really hold water.
In Georgia, the state Supreme Court just recently ruled money advanced to plaintiffs is not a loan, and related fees can't be regulated as interest. In Atlanta, I'm Bradley George for Marketplace.
And this final note on the way out. In a year marked by American companies spending record amounts on stock buybacks, here's a bit of a twist. At a gratitude lunch yesterday for employees of home health care company Beata in Philadelphia, founder Mark Beata announced a surprise $20 million bonus for his staff. The money will be distributed to employees based on how long they've been with the company, which is getting ready to transition from a private firm to a nonprofit. The company has more than 26,000 employees in 22 states. All right, we gotta go. Markets were closed for the Thanksgiving holiday. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, Heron Bakella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deidre Depke, and I'm Kimberly Adams. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.